Well, we have just a really well-disciplined panel here this morning, and we've actually got some time for questions, and I'm going to start off with a couple of quick ones. The question of second incomes came up in Bob's remarks, and Dick referred to Wade Horn, of course, before he was in the government, was the head of something called the National Fatherhood Initiative. Ron talked about the need for continuing supports for work. I think that Wade Horn in the administration would also say government ought to be in the business of ensuring that second income through the encouragement of marriage. Is that outside of what the government ought to be doing, or is there should that be more explicitly on the agenda?
To me, this is really a false choice because government is deeply involved in marriage already. We have lots of penalties in our cash programs and in other welfare programs. We have penalties in the tax code. Sometimes we even have rewards. The EITC, the best evidence now, is actually a reward for marriage. That's very surprising to me, but there's a very nice analysis by the Urban Institute on this by a guy named Greg Riach. But I think marriage, it is absolutely it is the most fundamental problem. That and non-marital births, and obviously, as you can see, they're closely related. That is a huge problem. We have to send a very clear message that people that aren't married shouldn't have babies. And believe it or not, ironically, the greatest president we've ever had on this issue is William Jefferson Clinton. He was very clear about this. He constantly went into black churches and said, you simply must stop having babies outside marriage. We are not going to be able to make progress against poverty unless we can stop this problem. And I think that's right. I mean, we can make progress. We've made progress. But I think we've reached a plateau. And I don't look for big new expenditures of the kind that would pull more people out of poverty. I think it's going to have to come from them. And combining income would clearly be the next step. There are a number of very interesting statistical analyses that show that if we had the poverty rate that we had if we had the marriage rate that we had in 1970, that it would reduce poverty by almost 30% without any new government spending. So marriage, yes, is absolutely a key. I don't know what government's going to be able to do, but we're taking the right approach. This is amazing for a Republican administration. Huge random assignment demonstration programs. 5 years from now, we will be able to speak knowledgeably about whether these programs work and A, increase marriage rates, and B, does that have impacts on children's development?
Can I just say one thing about that? I agree with Ron that marriage is important. The only mild difference between the New York's approach and the federal approach on this with the current administration is that we recognize the world as it is, and that is that for some families, they're not going to get married. A lot of families aren't going to get married. And I think that getting the benefits of greater father involvement in children's lives and greater income for those guys that are not getting married is important as well. And so I think you've got to be careful to let marriage and marriage initiatives, which are important, become bigger or a bigger distraction. I think you have to look at both sides.
Fascinating divide for government. Do we respond to what is, or do we focus on what should be, at least by some people's lives? EJ had some really interesting data on the cross-county variation here in New York State. And I wonder if, in terms of bringing down the welfare rate, I wonder, Bob, if you would want to address that and whether there ought to be some tinkering with the program to provide incentives for counties that could be described as laggards.
Well, first of all, EJ's data really focused on only one issue, and that's caseload reduction. So that's really not the full picture. We look at counties based on child support enforcement collections, child care subsidies. There's other factors going on in counties. The other thing that is that in New York State, we have a very varied economy between counties. And I would say that the state's role is to data, measure, show, set goals, but not dictate. Not say that they have that they have the only way of achieving certain goals, and allow the local counties to do the job that I believe they really have shown they can do very well. So the variation between counties has never, on that measure, has never really concerned me too much. I think you have to be careful if you expect an outcome in Nassau to be just as good as in Oswego. I just think they're very different places.
So goals, not quotas.
And I also should point out there's different leadership there. Different approaches, different political environment, different messages, not entirely in the control of the county local Department of Social Services.
We have something that we call our Diogenes Project, looking for something that's really hard to find out there, particularly in this political season, characterization that's good to use, and that is to look for places in the country where, because it is, Tip O'Neill was right, it is the local capability that puts things together in ways that fit different need and different situations of families and kids. And I have to tell you, it is not too encouraging. Mark Reagan, who was for like 10 years the analyst, 20 plus years analyst at HHS, you remember, Mark, he has gone all around the country working with Tom Gase and me, looking Diogenes style for systems that really put things together. And he's not encouraged. He is writing something that we've published in different forms that I've kiddingly told him should be, I retired to the real world. He was a Fed for 25 years, and now he works on our implementation studies. So I would just like to stress, and we're going to hear about that more in the next panel.
It doesn't surprise me that a federal official would go around and not be able to find what he wanted in local offices. I'm sorry to say that, little comment.
Well, I don't think that's fair, Robert.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But he doesn't withdraw it.
Yeah, no, I don't withdraw it.
I promise this is my last question, but I can't restrain myself. And the answers have been so succinct that we're going to have lots of time for other questions. But Dick Nathan said, we've got this kind of buffet of programs that are augmenting incomes. And that we should forget about negative income tax that he started off with in 30 plus years ago. Charles Murray, whose book Losing Ground arguably was a big factor in promoting welfare reform, has lately said, let's cash out all these programs, right? Housing assistance, Medicaid. Let's use the savings from not having to pay all that overhead, and we can supplement poor families' income even more and more reliably. And I'd love both Dick's and Ron's comment on that.
My comment is that Charlie has discovered what we're up to. That's all I'm going to say.
I'm going to think about that. What does that mean?
Okay, I'll talk to you later.
No, good. All right. It's a bad idea. And it's a bad idea because of all the holes it would leave. I know it's shocking to people in this room, but some public services actually do some good. And he's talking about cashing them all out. I wonder what's going to happen to all those abused and neglected kids if we don't have and not that it's an easy job and we do a great job of it. I'm not saying that. But I think there would be a lot more brutality and deaths and so forth among children if we didn't have a child protection system as imperfect as it is. And there are many other examples like that. So that's one reason it's a bad idea. The second reason it's a bad idea, I don't see how, and I regard Murray as brilliant. I agree that his book was a key part of welfare reform, helped to build the movement. But I don't see how you can say that giving people things is bad and then turn around and propose give, you know, what amounts to something like $15,000 or $18,000 or much as $20,000 to everybody. Why wouldn't it have the same bad effects? I do not want to give stuff away to people. We should not do that. They have to earn it. Well, so that's my problem.
I would only add that there are some circumstances in emergencies where we found in New York State, and I know this is an issue in Louisiana in the wake of Katrina, where the ability of our programs to quickly get assistance into people's hands through the EBT card by cashing out, by allowing them to use it for a variety of needs, could be very effective. In getting aid to people quickly.
But that's not the question.
But that is not the question.
I know. It's a lifelong, permanent, basically, you know, start life with all this money. It's not the American way.
Questions? If you have one, please come up to the are we having trouble with the sound system?
It's back.
Okay, it's back. So please come to a microphone, identify yourself, give your affiliation, and
here's one.
Shoot.
Well, I can talk less.
Okay.
My name is Renee Adamany. I teach human services, social work at Schenectady County Community College. And I just wondered if someone would address the whole I know when TANF changed, the work requirement education was not a part of that. And I wonder, we know statistics on education, people who earn more money over a lifetime if they have degrees, two-year, four-year, or PhD, and that is preventative. And I know, I can't remember which person talked about when you get people out of poverty, you know, they're just a little bit above poverty, and how do we break the cycle over a lifetime? And I see that education piece is missing, and I don't know if there's any talk about putting that back in as part of the work requirement or in addition to the work requirement, or you could address that in some way.
My understanding is that, and Ron, you would be better on this than I am, but there's a large body of data on experiences in work and training programs in the prior welfare reform period that they weren't very ultimately successful in getting folks into the workplace and raising their incomes. So the focus has been, in this new world, is that work has to come. We can combine or supplement that work with some forms of training and education, but there has to be a commitment, a serious commitment to work. And I think that's been successful. I don't deny that in other spheres, community college, public education, the college world, that we could do more in making education available at different hours and different times to low-income workers. But for our population, folks who are coming in seeking cash assistance, we really have to focus first on work.
Not a substitute, but a complement.
Not right.
Ron and I both said...
Wait, no. No, that's wrong. That undermines the answer. It's not work and education, it's work. That is the purpose of welfare reform. And we had many members of Congress, Republicans, that argued publicly, this bill is biased against education. We don't think it's the responsibility of the welfare system to educate people. It's the responsibility to get them to be self-sufficient and independent through work. That's the goal of welfare. And that's how states should spend this money. And we have a number of provisions in the bill that limit its use for education. Doesn't eliminate it, but it limits it. And those were not changed much in the recent legislation. And I think even if the Democrats had control of both House and the Senate, they would have to be very cautious converting a system that now promotes work very effectively into one that allows education, because we have tons of studies. Larry Mead could probably start right now and half hour later and naming the studies that show that education with low-income families has been largely unsuccessful.
But I don't think...
I was just saying that other parts of government, not the 10.
Oh. And I don't think that we don't... I feel that there is an emerging issue with regard to wage rates and compensation levels for lower middle class folks, and that's just another subject where education is going to play a role. It's not, in my opinion, the welfare policy sphere's responsibility.
Okay, but here's the key thing.
Let me just say one thing.
It'll take 10 seconds. If you think that you can suddenly pluck your magic twanger and get all these low-income families to go to junior college and have skills that are going to get them $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year, it is not going to happen. We do not know how to do that. Those programs have failed. We need to figure out how to do it. Then we can change the system once we figure out how to do it successfully.
That's quite sweeping, Ron. And I have conflicted feelings about this. As somebody who had 20-plus years on the MDRC board, and Ron's on that board now, that was one thing that was clear in our studies, was that the work-first, low-cost programs showed high, significant impacts compared to, as Ron has been saying, other more elaborate employment programs and training programs. At the same time, though, what reason I'm conflicted is, at one point I was active at the National Academy of Science on a panel on preparing for the workforce. And what I learned from that is the most significant thing that's happened to education policy in the country in the last 20 years is the growth of community colleges. They do all kinds of interesting things that put people in jobs where jobs are being created. That connection's very important. I understand that if you make it intrinsic to how you get benefits, you get into some areas where we haven't been able to do it well, but we shouldn't give up on combining work and the way a lot of people do it, taking advantage particularly of community colleges.
Another question. Yes, sir.
Joel Margolis, private citizen. I don't think this works. Are there any studies showing the views of mothers who have left the welfare system in terms of how they view welfare now, in terms of what they're teaching their children about how welfare should be perceived.
In the early years, we did work on a study that did do some survey results, and we found that the majority of folks who had left welfare, this is my memory, did feel that they were better off, and they were that was the principal finding. Not everybody, but they felt they were better off, and that was an indication, I think, of progress. And I, intuitively, I think that would be true. But
for a while, we were doing lever studies. Lots of states were doing them, and they were getting to be kind of rich and sophisticated, but then they stopped doing them, I think.
We've got time for one more question. Yes.
You can,
just,
we can
just
hear
speak
you.
Loud.
We can
hear you.
My name is Andy Singh. I'm from RSS here in Albany, one of the welfare to work providers.
Thank you.
And my question is also about the regs. There are 4 weeks of training annually, and then after that 4 weeks, in the work requirements, an actual job search is not included as a work countable activity. So an individual could be doing volunteering or work experience, but not the actual job search. That doesn't actually count towards a work requirement. So could you comment on that?
Well, the second panel is going to get into this in greater detail, and Deputy Commissioner Sykes is here. So I can't recall specifically what the changes. It's definitely a tougher row to hoe. There's no question. They've taken some things that we in New York used to count as work participation and said we can't do that any longer. And that's going to be a struggle for New York. That's the struggle that Ron commented on. We commented to the federal government and asked them to allow us greater flexibility, but they did not do that. So you're right to say there are areas that we were able to count as work participation, which we can't any longer, and now we have to step up to it. And I think the next panel will get into that in greater detail.
Thanks for that question. It's a perfect transition to our next panel. Please join me in thanking our panelists, and we'll take a 10-minute break.